Waterhouse opens up his attaché case, splotched and streaked with salt from his voyages to and from Tagum, and draws out two manila envelopes. "These are the copies I made before I sent the originals down to Bletchley Park," he says, patting one of them. "They are much more legible than the originals." He pats the other envelope, which they were kind enough to lend me this morning so that I could study them again. "Show the originals," Alan says. Waterhouse slides the second envelope, encrusted with top-secret stamps, across the table. Alan opens the envelope so hastily that he tears it and jerks out the pages. He spreads them out on the table. His mouth drops open in purest astonishment. For a moment, Waterhouse is fooled. The expression on Alan's face makes him think that his friend has, in some Olympian burst of genius, deciphered the messages in an instant just by looking at them. But that's not it at all. Thunderstruck, he finally says, "I recognize this handwriting."
"You do?" Waterhouse says.
"Yes. I've seen it 1,000 times. These pages were written out by our old bicycling friend, Rudolf von Hackelheber. Rudy wrote those pages." Waterhouse spends much of the next week commuting to London for meetings at the Broadway buildings. Whenever civilian authorities are going to be present at a meeting, especially civilians with expensive-sounding accents, Colonel Chatton always shows up, and before the meeting starts, always finds some frightfully cheerful and oblique way to tell Waterhouse to keep his trap shut, unless someone asks a math question. Waterhouse is not offended. He prefers it, actually, because it leaves his mind free to work on important things. During their last meeting at the Broadway buildings, Waterhouse proved a theorem. It takes Waterhouse about 3 days to figure that the meetings themselves make no sense. He reckons that there is no imaginable goal that could be furthered by what they are discussing. He even makes a few stabs at proving that this is so using formal logic, but he is weak in this area and doesn't know enough of the underlying axioms to reach a QED. By the end of the week, though, he has figured out that these meetings are just one ramification of the Yamamoto assassination. Winston Spencer Churchill is very fond indeed of Bletchley Park and all its works, and he places the highest priority on preserving its secrecy. But the interception of Yamamoto's airplane has blown a gaping hole in the screen of deception. The Americans responsible for this appalling gaffe are now trying to cover their asses by spreading a story that Native Islander spies caught wind of Yamamoto's trip and radioed the news to Guadalcanal, whence the fatal P-38s were dispatched. But the P-38s were operating at the extreme limit of their fuel range and would have had to be sent out at precisely the correct time in order to make it back to Guadalcanal, so the Japanese would have to have their heads several feet up their asses to fall for that. Winston Churchill is pissed off in the extreme, and these meetings represent a prolonged bureaucratic hissy fit intended to produce some meaningful and enduring policy shift. Every evening after the meetings, Waterhouse takes the tube to Euston and the train to Bletchley, and sits up late working on Rudy's numbers. Alan has been working on them during the daytime, so the two of them, combining their efforts, can almost pound away on it round the clock. Not all of the riddles are mathematical. For example, why the hell do the Germans have Rudy copying out big long numbers by hand? If the letters do indeed represent big numbers, that would indicate that Dr. Rudolf von Hackelheber had been assigned to a job as a mere cipher clerk. This would not be the stupidest move ever made by a bureaucracy, but it seems unlikely. And what little intelligence they've been able to gather from Germany suggests that Rudy has, in fact, been given a rather important job, important enough to keep extremely secret. Alan's hypothesis is that Waterhouse has been making an understandable but totally wrong assumption. The numbers are not ciphertext. They are, rather, one-time pads that the skipper of the U-553 was supposed to have used to encrypt certain messages too sensitive to go out over the regular Enigma channel. These one-time pads were, for some reason, drawn up personally by Rudy himself. Usually, making one-time pads is just as lowly a job as enciphering messages, a job for clerks who use decks of cards or bingo machines to choose letters at random.
But Allen and Waterhouse are now operating on the assumption that this encryption scheme is a radical new invention, presumably an invention of Rudy's, in which the pads are generated not at random, but by using some mathematical algorithm. In other words, there is some calculation, some equation that Rudy has dreamed up. You give it a value, probably the date, and possibly some other information as well, such as an arbitrary key phrase or a number. You crank through the steps of the calculation, and the result is a number, some 900 digits long, which is 3,000 binary digits, which gives you 600 letters, enough to cover one sheet of paper, when you convert it using the BODO code. The 900-digit decimal number, the 3,000-digit binary number, and the 600 letters are all the same abstract, pure number, encoded differently. Meanwhile, your counterpart, probably on the other side of the world, is going through the same calculation and coming up with the same one-time pad. When you send him a message encrypted using the day's pad, he can decipher it. If Turing and Waterhouse can figure out how the calculation works, they can read all of these messages, too. Freaking. The dentist is gone, the door locked, the phone unplugged. Randall Lawrence Waterhouse lies naked on the starched, turned-down sheets of his king-sized bed. His head is propped up on a pillow so that he can peer through the V of his feet at a BBC World Service newscast on the television. A $10 minibar beer is near at hand. It's 6 in the morning in America, and so rather than a pro basketball game, he has to settle for this BBC newscast, which is strongly geared to South Asian happenings. A long and very sober story about a plague of locusts on the India-Pakistan border follows a piece on a typhoon about to nail Hong Kong. The King of Thailand is calling in some of his government's more corrupt officials to literally prostrate themselves before him. Asian news always has this edge of the fantastic to it, but it's all dead serious, no nods or winks anywhere. Now he's watching a story about a nervous system disease that people in New Guinea come down with, as a consequence of eating other people's brains. Just your basic cannibal story. No wonder so many Americans come here on business and never really go home again. It's like stepping into the pages of classics comics. Someone is knocking on his door. Randy gets up and puts on his plush white hotel bathrobe. He peers through the peephole, half expecting to see a pygmy standing there with a blowpipe, though he wouldn't mind a seductive oriental courtesan. But it's just Cantrell. Randy opens the door. Cantrell is already holding up his hands, palms out in a cheerful, shut-up-already gesture.
Don't worry, Cantrell says. I'm not here to talk about biz.
In that case, I won't break this beer bottle over your head, Randy says. Cantrell must feel exactly the same way Randy does, which is that so much wild shit happened today that the only way to deal with it is not to talk about it at all. Most of the brain's work is done while the brain's owner is ostensibly thinking about something else, so sometimes you have to deliberately find something else to think and talk about.
Come to my room, Cantrell says. Pekka is here.
The Finn who got blown up?
The same.
Why is he here?
Because there's no reason not to be. After he got blown up, he adopted a techno-nomadic lifestyle.
So it's just a coincidence or...
Nah, Cantrell says. He's helping me win a bet.
What kind of bet?
I was telling Tom Howard about Van Eck freaking a few weeks ago. Tom said it sounded like bullshit. He bet me 10 shares of Epiphyte stock that I couldn't make it actually work outside of a laboratory.
Is Pekka good at that kind of thing? By way of saying yes, Cantrell adopts a serious look and says,
Pekka is writing a whole chapter about it for the Cryptonomicon. Pekka feels that only by mastering the technologies that might be used against us can we defend ourselves.
This sounds almost like a call to arms. Randy would have to be some kind of loser to retreat to his bed after that. So he backs into the room and steps into his trousers, which are standing there telescoped into the floor where he dropped them upon his return from the Sultan's palace. The Sultan's palace. The television is now broadcasting a news story about pirates plying the waters of the South China Sea, making freighter crews walk the plank. This whole continent is like fucking Disneyland without the safety precautions, Randy observes. Am I the only person who finds it surreal? Cantrell grins, but says,
If we begin talking about surreal, we'll end up talking about today.
You got that right, Randy says. Let's go. Before Pekka became known around Silicon Valley as the Finn who got blown up, he was known as Cello Guy, because he had a nearly autistic devotion to his cello and took it with him everywhere, always trying to stuff it into overhead luggage racks. Not coincidentally, he was an analog kind of guy from way back whose specialty was radio. When packet radio started to get big as an alternative to sending data down wires, Pekka moved to Menlo Park and joined a startup. His company bought their equipment at used computer stores, and Pekka ended up scoring a pretty nice 19-inch high-res multi-sync monitor, perfectly adequate for his adaptable 24-year-old eyes. He hooked it up to a slightly used Pentium box jammed full of RAM. He also installed Phinix, a free Unix operating system created by Finns, almost as a way of proclaiming to the rest of the world, "This is how weird we are," and distributed throughout the world on the net. Of course, Phinix was fantastically powerful and flexible and enabled you, among other things, to control the machine's video circuitry to the nth degree and choose many different scanning frequencies and pixel clocks, if you were into that kind of thing. Pekka most definitely was into it, and so like a lot of Phinix maniacs, he set his machine up so that it could display, if he chose, a whole lot of tiny little pixels, which displayed a lot of information but was hard on the eyes, or alternatively, fewer and larger pixels, which he tended to use after he had been hacking for 24 hours straight and lost ocular muscle tone, or various settings in between. Every time he changed from one setting to another, the monitor screen would go black for a second, and there would be an audible clunk from inside of it, as the resonating crystals inside locked in on a different range of frequencies. One night at 3 a.m., Pekka caused this to happen, and immediately after the screen went black and made that clunking noise, it exploded in his face. The front of the picture tube was made of heavy glass. It had to be to withstand the internal vacuum, which fragmented and sped into Pekka's face, neck, and upper body. The very same phosphors that had been glowing beneath the sweeping electron beam moments before, conveying information into Pekka's eyes, were now physically embedded in his flesh. A hunk of glass took one of his eyes and almost went through into his brain. Another one gouged out his voice box. Another zinged past the side of his head and bit a neat triangular hunk out of his left ear. Pekka, in other words, was the first victim of the digibomber. He almost bled to death on the spot, and his fellow eutropians hovered around his hospital bed for a few days with tanks of Freon ready to jump into action in case he died. But he didn't, and he got even more press because his startup company lacked health insurance. After a lot of hand-wringing in local newspapers about how this poor innocent from the land of socialized medicine had not had the presence of mind to buy health insurance, some rich high-tech guys donated money to pay his medical bills and to equip him with a computer voice box like Stephen Hawking's. And now here is Pekka, sitting in Cantrell's hotel room. His cello stands in the corner, dusty around the bridge from powdered rosin. He is facing a blank wall to which he has duct-taped a bunch of wires in precise loops and whorls. These lead to some home-brewed circuit boards, which are in turn hooked up to his laptop.
"Hello, Randy. Congratulations on your success," says a computer-generated voice, as soon as the door is shut behind Randy and Cantrell.
This is a little greeting that Pekka has obviously typed in ahead of time, anticipating his arrival. None of the foregoing seems particularly odd to Randy, except for the fact that Pekka seems to think that Epiphyte has already achieved some kind of success.
"How are you doing?"
Cantrell asks. Pekka types in a response. Then he cups one hand to his mutilated ear while using his other hand to cue the voice generator.
"He showers."
Indeed, it's possible now to hear the pipes hissing in the wall.
"His laptop radiates."
"Oh," Randy says. "Tom Howard's room is right next door?"
"Just on the other side of that wall," Cantrell says. "I specifically requested it so that I could win this bet. See, his room is a mirror image of this one, so his computer is only a few inches away, just on the other side of this wall. Perfect conditions for Van Eck freaking.
Pekka, are you receiving signals from his computer right now? Randy asks.
Pekka nods, types, and fires back,
I tune, I calibrate.
The input device for his voice generator is a one-handed cord board strapped to his thigh. He puts his right hand on it and makes flopping and groping motions. Moments later, speech emerges.
I require Cantrell.
Excuse me, Cantrell says,
and goes to Pekka's side. Randy watches over their shoulders for a bit, understanding vaguely what they're doing. If you lay a sheet of white paper on an old gravestone and sweep the tip of a pencil across it, you get one horizontal line, dark in some places and faint in others, and not very meaningful. If you move downwards on the page by a small distance, a single pencil line width, and repeat, an image begins to emerge. The process of working your way down the page in a series of horizontal sweeps is what a nerd would call raster scanning, or just rastering. With a conventional video monitor, a cathode ray tube, the electron beam physically rasters down the glass something like 60 to 80 times a second. In the case of a laptop screen like Randy's, there is no physical scanning. The individual pixels are turned on or off directly, but still, a scanning process is taking place. What's being scanned and made manifest on the screen is a region of the computer's memory called the screen buffer. The contents of the screen buffer have to be slapped up onto the screen 60 to 80 times every second, or else, 1, the screen flickers, and 2, the images move jerkily. The way that the computer talks to you is not by controlling the screen directly, but rather by manipulating the bits contained in that buffer, secure in the knowledge that other subsystems inside the machine handle the drudge work of pipelining that information onto the actual physical screen. 60 to 80 times a second, the video system says, shit, time to refresh the screen again, and goes to the beginning of the screen buffer, which is just a particular hunk of memory, remember, and it reads the first few bytes, which dictate what color the pixel in the upper left-hand corner of the screen is supposed to be. This information is sent on down the line to whatever is actually refreshing the screen, whether it's a scanning electron beam or some laptop-style system for directly controlling the pixels. Then the next few bytes are read, typically for the pixel just to the right of that first one, and so on all the way to the right edge of the screen. That draws the first line of the grave rubbing. Since the right edge of the screen has now been reached, there are no more pixels off in that direction. It is implicit that the next bytes read from memory will be for the leftmost pixel in the second raster line down from the top. If this is a cathode ray tube type of screen, we have a little timing problem here in that the electron beam is currently at the right edge of the screen, and now it's being asked to draw a pixel at the left edge. It has to move back. This takes a little while, not long, but much longer than the interval of time between drawing two pixels that are cheek by jowl. This pause is called the horizontal retrace interval. Another one will occur at the end of every other line until the rastering has proceeded to the last pixel at the bottom right-hand corner of the screen and completed a single grave rubbing. But then it's time to begin the process all over again, and so the electron beam, if there is one, has to jump diagonally all the way up to the upper left-hand pixel. This also takes a little while and is called the vertical retrace interval. These issues all stem from inherent physical limitations of sweeping electron beams through space in a cathode ray tube and basically disappear. In the case of a laptop screen like the one Tom Howard has set up a few inches in front of Pekka on the other side of that wall. But the video timing of a laptop screen is still patterned after that of a cathode ray tube screen anyway. This is simply because the old technology is universally understood by those who need to understand it, and it works well. And all kinds of electronic and software technology has been built and tested to work within that framework, and why mess with success? Especially when your profit margins are so small that they can only be detected by using techniques from quantum mechanics, and any glitches vis-a-vis compatibility with old stuff will send your company straight into the toilet. On Tom's laptop, each second of time is divided into 75 perfectly regular slices. during which a full grave rubbing is performed, followed by a vertical retrace interval. Randy can follow Pekka and Cantrell's conversation well enough to gather that they have already figured out, from analyzing the signals coming through the wall, that Tom Howard has his screen set up to give him 768 lines and 1,024 pixels on each line. For every pixel, 4 bytes will be read from the video buffer and sent on down the line to the screen. Tom is using the highest possible level of color definition on his screen, which means that 1 byte apiece is needed to represent the intensity of blue, green, and red, and another is basically left over, but kept in there anyway because computers like powers of 2, and computers are so ridiculously fast and powerful now that even though all of this is happening on a timetable that would strike a human being as rather aggressive, the extra bytes just don't make any difference. Each byte is 8 binary digits, or bits, and so 1024 times a line, 4 times 8 equals 32 bits, are being read from the screen buffer. Unbeknownst to Tom, his computer happens to be sitting right next to an antenna. The wires Pekka taped to the wall can read the electromagnetic waves that are radiating out of the computer's circuitry at all times. Tom's laptop is sold as a computer, not as a radio station, and so it might seem odd that it should be radiating anything at all. It is all a byproduct of the fact that computers are binary critters, which means that all chip-to-chip, subsystem-to-subsystem communications taking place inside the machine, everything moving down those flat ribbons of wire and the little metallic traces on the circuit boards, consists of transitions from 0 to 1 and back again. The way that you represent bits in a computer is by switching the wire's voltage back and forth between 0 and 5 volts. In computer textbooks, these transitions are always graphed as if they were perfect square waves, meaning that you have this perfectly flat line at V equals 0, representing a binary 0, and then it makes a perfect right-angle turn and jumps vertically to V equals 5, and then executes another perfect right-angle turn and remains at 5 volts until it's time to go back to 0 again, and so on. This is the Platonic ideal of how computer circuitry is supposed to operate, but engineers have to build actual circuits in the grimy analog world. The hunks of metal and silicon can't manifest the platonic behavior shown in those textbooks. Circuits can jump between 0 and 5 volts really, really abruptly, but if you monitor them on an oscilloscope, you would see that it's not a perfectly square wave. Instead, you get something that looks like little waves that are called ringing. These transitions among binary digits hit the circuitry like a clapper striking a bell. The voltage jumps, but after it jumps, it oscillates back and forth around the new value for a little while. Whenever you have an oscillating voltage in a conductor like this, it means that electromagnetic waves are propagating out into space. Consequently, each wire in a running computer is like a little radio transmitter. The signals that it broadcasts are completely dependent upon the details of what's going on inside the machine. Since there are a lot of wires in there and the particulars of what they are doing are fairly unpredictable, it is difficult for anyone monitoring the transmissions to make head or tail of them. A great deal of what comes out of the machine is completely irrelevant from a surveillance point of view, but there is one pattern of signals that is, 1, totally predictable, and 2, exactly what Pekka wants to see, and that is the stream of bytes being read from the screen buffer and sent down the wire to the screen hardware. Amid all the random noise coming from the machine, the ticks of the horizontal and vertical retrace intervals will stand out as clearly as the beating of a drum in a teeming jungle. Now that Pekka has zeroed in on that beat, he should be able to pick up the radiation emanating from the wire that connects screen buffer to video hardware and translate it back into a sequence of ones and zeros that can be dumped out onto their own screen. They will be able to see exactly what Tom Howard sees through the kind of surveillance called Van Eck freaking. That's what Randy knows. When it comes to the details, Cantrell and Pekka are way out of his league, so after a few minutes he feels himself losing interest. He sits down on Cantrell's bed, which is the only place left to sit, and discovers a little palm-top computer on the bedside table. It is already up and running, patched into the world over a telephone wire. Randy's heard of this product. It is supposed to be a first stab at a network computer, and so it's running a web browser whenever it is turned on. The web browser is the interface.
"May I surf?"
Randy asks, and Cantrell says,
"Yes,"
without even turning around. Randy visits one of the big web searching sites, which takes a minute because the machine has to establish a net connection first. Then he searches for web documents containing the terms Andy or Andrew Loeb and Hive Mind. As usual, the search finds tens of thousands of documents, but it's not hard for Randy to pick out the relevant ones. YRIST RIST 9E03 is a member in good standing of the California Bar Association. RIST 11A4 has experienced ambivalent feelings over the fact that RIST 9E03, insofar as she-he is construed by atomized society as an individual organism, is a lawyer. No doubt the conflicted feelings of RIST 11A4 are quite normal and natural. Part of RIST 11A4 abhors lawyers, and the legal system in general, as symptoms of the end-stage terminal disease of atomized society. Another part understands that disease can improve the health of the meme pool if it slays an organism that is old and unfit for ongoing propagation of its meme-o-type. Make no mistake about it, the legal system in its current form is the worst imaginable system for society to resolve its disputes. It is appallingly expensive in terms of money and in terms of the intellectual talent that goes to waste pursuing it as a career. But part of RIST 11A4 feels that the goals of RIST 11A4 may actually be served by turning the legal system's most toxic features against the rotten body politic of atomized society and, in so doing, hasten its downfall. Randy clicks on RIST 9E03 and gets, RIST 9E03 is the RIST that RIST 11A4 denotes by the arbitrarily chosen bit pattern that, construed as an integer, is 9E03 in hexadecimal notation. Click here for more about the system of bit pattern designators used by RIST 11A4 to replace the obsolescent nomenclature systems of natural languages. Click here if you would like the designator RIST 9E03 to be automatically replaced by a conventional designator name as you browse this website. Click. From now on, the expression RIST 9E03 will be replaced by the expression Andrew Loeb. Warning. We consider such nomenclature fundamentally invalid and do not recommend its use, but have provided it as a service to first-time visitors to this website who are not accustomed to thinking in terms of RISTs. Click. You have clicked on Andrew Loeb, which is a designator assigned by atomized society to the memome of RIST 9E03. Click. Memome is the set of all memes that define the physical reality of a carbon-based RIST. Memes can be divided into two broad categories, genetic and semantic. Genetic memes are simply genes, DNA, and are propagated through normal biological reproduction. Semantic memes are ideas, ideologies, religions, fads, etc., and are propagated by communications. Click. The genetic part of the memome of Andrew Loeb shares 99% of his contents with the data set produced by the Human Genome Project. This should not be construed as endorsing the concept of speciation, i.e., that the continuum of carbon-based life forms can or should be arbitrarily partitioned into paradigmatic species, in general, or the theory that there is a species called Homo sapiens in particular. The semantic part of the memome of Andrew Loeb is still unavoidably contaminated with many primitive viral memes, but these are being gradually and steadily supplanted by new semantic memes generated ab initio by rational processes. Click. RIST stands for Relatively Independent Subtotality. It can be used to refer to any entity that, from one point of view, seems to possess a clear boundary separating it from the world, as do cells in a body, but that, in a deeper sense, is inextricably linked with a larger totality, as are cells in a body. For example, the biological entities, traditionally known as human beings, are nothing more than relatively independent subtotalities of the social organism in which they are embedded. a dissertation written under the name Andrew Loeb, who is now designated RIST 9E03, indicates that even in those parts of RIST 0577, having temperate climates and abundant food and water, the life of an organism such as the type designated in old meme systems as Homo sapiens would have been primarily occupied with attempting to eat other RISTs. This narrow focus would inhibit the formation of advanced semantic meme systems, namely, civilization, as that word is traditionally construed. RISTs of this type can only attain higher levels of functioning insofar as they are embedded in a larger society, the most logical evolutionary endpoint of which is a hive mind. Click. A hive mind is a social organization of RISTs that are capable of processing semantic memes, thinking. These could be either carbon-based or silicon-based. RISTs who enter a hive mind surrender their independent identities, which are mere illusions anyway. For purposes of convenience, the constituents of the hive mind are assigned bit pattern designators. Click. A bit pattern designator is a random series of bits used to uniquely identify a RIST. For example, the organism traditionally designed as Earth, Terra, Gaia, has been assigned the designator 0577. This website is maintained by 11A4, which is a hive mind. RIST 11A4 assigns bit pattern designators with a pseudo-random number generator. This departs from the practice used by that soi-distant hive mind, known to itself as the East Bay Area Hive Mind Project, but designated, in the system of RIST 11A4, as RIST E77-2. This hive mind resulted from the division of Hive Mind 1, designated in the system of RIST 11A4 as RIST 4032, into several smaller hive minds. The East Bay Area Hive Mind Project, the San Francisco Hive Mind, Hive Mind 1A, the reorganized San Francisco Hive Mind, and the Universal Hive Mind, as the result of an irreconcilable contradiction between several different semantic memes that competed for mindshare. One of these semantic memes asserted that bit pattern designators should be assigned in numerical order, so that, for example, Hive Mind 1 would be designated RIST 0001, and so on. Another meme asserted that numbers should be organized in order of importance, so that, for example, the RIST conventionally known as the planet Earth would be RIST 0001. Another semantic meme agreed with this one but disagreed as to whether the counting should begin with 0000 or 0001. Within both the 0000 and 0001 camps, there was disagreement about what RIST should be assigned the first number. Some asserted that Earth was the first and most important RIST. Others, that some larger system, the solar system, the universe, God, was in some sense more inclusive and fundamental. This machine has an email interface. Randy uses it. 2. root@arutatorium.org. From dwarf@siblings.net. Subject, re, 2. Why? Saw the website. Am willing to stipulate that you are not RIST 9E03. Suspect that you are the dentist who yearns for honest exchange of views. Anonymous, digitally signed email is the only safe vehicle for same. If you want me to believe you are not the dentist, provide plausible explanation for your question regarding why we are building the crypt. Yours truly, begin ordo signature block, etc. End ordo signature block.
We've got bits,
Cantrell says.
Are you in the middle of something?
Nothing I'm not eager to get out of, Randy says, putting the palm top down. He gets off the bed and stands behind Pekka. The screen of Pekka's computer has a number of windows on it, of which the biggest and frontmost is the image of another computer's screen. Nested within that are various other windows and icons. A desktop. It happens to be a Windows NT desktop, which is noteworthy and, to Randy, bizarre because Pekka's computer isn't running Windows NT, it's running Phoenix. A cursor is moving around on that Windows NT desktop, pulling down menus and clicking on things, but Pekka's hand is not moving. The cursor zooms over to a Microsoft Word icon, which changes color and expands to form a large window. This copy of Microsoft Word is registered to Thomas Howard.
You did it, Randy says.
We see what Tom sees,
Pekka says. A new document window opens up, and words begin to spill across it.
Note to myself. Let's see letters to Penthouse print this. I don't suppose that graduate students of either gender are exactly sought out by sexual connoisseurs for their great fucking skills. We think about it too much. Everything has to be verbalized. A person who believes that fucking is a sexual discourse is simply never going to be any good in the sack. I have a thing about stockings. They have to be sheer black stockings, preferably with seams up the back. When I was 13 years old, I actually shoplifted some black pantyhose from a grocery store just so that I could play with them. Walking out of that store with those legs in my backpack, my heart was pounding. But the excitement of the crime was nothing compared to opening up the package and pulling them out, rubbing them against my fuzzy adolescent cheeks. I even tried pulling them on, but this just looked grotesque, what with my hairy legs, and did absolutely nothing for me. I didn't want to wear them. I wanted someone else to. I masturbated 4 times that day. It disturbed the shit out of me when I thought about it. I was a smart boy. Smart boys are supposed to be rational. So when I was in college, I figured out a rationalization for this. There weren't that many women who wore sheer black stockings in college, but sometimes I would go into the city and see the well-dressed office workers walking down the street on their lunch breaks and make scientific observations of their legs. I noticed that where the stocking stretched itself thin to go over a wide part of the leg, such as the muscle of the calf, it became paler, just as a colored balloon becomes paler when it is inflated. Conversely, it was darker in narrow regions, such as the ankle. This made the calf look more shapely and the ankle look more slender. The legs, as a whole, looked healthier, implying that just above the place where they joined together, a higher class of DNA was to be found. QED, my thing about black stockings, was a highly rational adaptation. It merely proved how smart I was, how rational even the most irrational parts of my brain were. Sex held no power over me. It was nothing to fear. This was quintessentially sophomoric thinking. But nowadays, most educated people hold quintessentially sophomoric opinions well into their 30s. And so, this stuck with me for a long time. My wife, Virginia, probably has some equally self-serving rationalization for her own sexual needs, of which I was not to become aware for many years. So it's no surprise that our premarital sex life was mediocre. Neither one of us admitted it was mediocre, of course. If I had admitted it, I would have had to admit that it was mediocre because Virginia didn't like to wear stockings. And at the time, I was too concerned with being a sensitive New Age guy to admit such heresy. I loved Virginia for her mind. How could I be so shallow, so insensitive, so perverse as to spurn her because she didn't like to pull filmy tubes of nylon over her legs? As a pudgy nerd, I was lucky to have her. 5 years into our marriage, I attended the Comdex convention as president of a small new high-tech company. I was a little less pudgy and a little less nerdy. I met a marketing girl for a big software distribution chain. She was wearing sheer black stockings. We ended up fucking in my hotel room. It was the best sex I'd ever had. I went home baffled and ashamed. After that, my sex life with Virginia was pretty miserable. We had sex maybe a dozen times over the next couple of years. Virginia's grandmother died, and we went back to upstate New York for the funeral. Virginia had to wear a dress, which meant she had to shave her legs and wear stockings, something she'd done on only a handful of occasions since our marriage. I practically fell over her when I saw her, and suffered through the funeral with a big, scratchy erection, trying to figure out how I could get her alone. Now, Granny had lived by herself in a big old house on a hill until a couple of months earlier when she had fallen down and broken her hip and been moved into a nursing home. All of her children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren came together for the funeral, and that house became the central gathering place. It was a nice place, full of good old furniture. but in her declining years, Granny had become something of a compulsive pack rat, and so there were heaps of newspapers and accumulated mail squirreled away everywhere. In the end, we had to haul away several truckloads of junk. In some other ways, Granny had been pretty well organized and had left behind a very specific last will and testament. Each one of her descendants knew exactly which pieces of furniture, dishes, rugs, and curios they were going to take home. She had a lot of possessions, but she also had a lot of descendants, and so the loot had to be sliced pretty thin. Virginia ended up with a black walnut dresser, which was stored in an unused bedroom. We went up there to have a look at it, and I ended up fucking her there. I stood up with the flimsy trousers of my dark suit collapsed around my ankles while she sat on top of that dresser with her legs wrapped around me and her stocking-clad heels digging into my butt cheeks. It was the best fuck we'd ever had, bar none. Fortunately, there were a lot of people eating, drinking, and talking downstairs, or they would have heard her moaning and hollering. I finally came clean to her about the stockings. It felt good. I'd been reading a lot about how the brain develops and had finally come to accept my stocking kink. It seems that when you are a certain age, somewhere between 2 and 5 years, your mind just gels. The part of it that's responsible for sex becomes set into a pattern that you'll carry with you for the rest of your life. All of the gay people I've ever discussed it with have told me that they knew they were gay, or at least different, years before they even began thinking about sex, and all of them agree that gayness cannot be converted into straightness, or vice versa, no matter how hard you might try. The part of your brain that handles sex frequently gets crosswired into other, seemingly irrelevant areas at this age. This is when people pick up an orientation towards sexual dominance or submission, or when a lot of guys pick up highly specific kinks, say, rubber, feathers, or shoes. Some of them are unfortunate enough to get turned on by little kids, and those guys are essentially doomed from that point onwards. There is nothing to do except castrate them or lock them up. No therapy will unkink the brain once it is kinked. So, all things considered, being turned on by black stockings wasn't such a bad sexual card to have been dealt. I'd laid this all out to Virginia during the trip home. I was surprised by how calmly she accepted it. I was too big of a jerk to realize that she was thinking about how it all applied to her. After we got back home, she gamely went out and bought some stockings and tried to wear them on occasion. This was not easy. Stockings imply a whole lifestyle. They look stupid with jeans and sneakers. A woman in stockings has to wear a dress or a skirt, and not just a blue denim skirt, but something nicer, more formal. She also had to wear the type of shoes that Virginia didn't own and didn't like to wear. Stockings are not really compatible with riding a bicycle to work. They were not even really compatible with our house. During our frugal grad student days, we had accumulated a lot of furniture from Goodwill, or I had hammered it together myself out of 2x4s. This furniture turned out to be riddled with hidden snags that a person in blue jeans would never notice, but that would destroy a pair of stockings in a moment. Likewise, our half-finished house and our old junker cars had many small sharp edges that were death to stockings. On the other hand, when we went away for an anniversary trip to London, getting around in black taxis, staying in a nice hotel, and eating in good restaurants, we spent a whole week moving in a world that was perfectly adapted to stockings. It just went to show us how radically we would have to change our circumstances in order for her to dress that way routinely. So, much money was spent on stockings in a fit of good intentions. Some good sex was had, though I seemed to enjoy it much more than Virginia did. She never achieved the shocking animal intensity she had shown at Granny's house after the funeral. Attrition reduced her supply of stockings very quickly. Sheer inconvenience prevented her from renewing it. And within a year after the funeral, we were back to square one. Other things were changing, though. I made a lot of money by cashing in some stock options, and we bought a new house up in the hills. We hired some movers to come pick up all of our junky furniture and move it into that house, where it looked much shabbier. Virginia's new job forced her to commute in a car. I didn't think our old junker was safe, and so I bought her a nice little Lexus with leather seats and wool carpet, all of it nicely snag free. Soon, kids came along, and I traded in my old beater pickup truck for a minivan. Still, I couldn't bring myself to begin spending money on furniture until my back started going bad on me, and I realized it was because of the slack 20-year-old Goodwill mattress that Virginia and I were sleeping on. We had to buy a new bed. Since it was my back at stake, I went out and did the shopping. I'd rather stub out cigarettes on my tongue than go shopping. The idea of hitting every big furniture store in the area comparing beds made me want to die. All I wanted was to go to one place and buy a bed and have done with it. But I didn't want a shitty bed that I'd be sick of in a year or a cheap mattress that would mess up my back again in 5 years. So I went straight down to my local Gomer Baldstrud Home Gallery. I had heard people talk about Gomer Baldstrud furniture. Women in particular seemed to speak of it in hushed religious tones. Their factory was said to be up in some New England town where they had been based for the last 300 years. It was said that loose curls of walnut and oak from Gomer Baldstrud's block plane had been used as tinder beneath the pyres of convicted witches. Gomer Baldstrud was the answer to a question I'd been ruminating over ever since Granny's funeral. Namely, where does all of this high-quality grandma furniture come from? In every family, young people go to grandma's house for Thanksgiving or other obligatory visits and lust over the nice antique furniture, wondering which pieces they will take home when the old lady kicks the bucket. Some people lose patience and go to estate sales or antique stores and buy the stuff. But if the supply of old, high-grade, heirloom-quality furniture is fixed, then where will the grannies of the future come from? I could see a situation, half a century in the future, when Virginia's and my descendants would all be squabbling over that one black walnut dresser, while bringing in rider trucks to haul the rest of our stuff straight to the dump. As the population grows and the supply of old furniture remains constant, this kind of thing is inevitable. There must be a source for new granny-grade furniture, or else the Americans of tomorrow will all end up sitting in vinyl beanbag chairs, leaking little foam beads all over the floor. The answer is Gomer Baldstrud, and the price is high. Each Gomer Baldstrud chair and table really ought to come in a little felt-lined box like a piece of jewelry. But at the time, I was rich and impatient. So I drove to Gomer Baldstrud and stormed through the door, only to be brought up short by a receptionist. I felt tacky in my white tennis shoes and jeans. She had probably seen a lot of high-tech millionaires come through those doors and took it pretty calmly. Before I knew it, a middle-aged woman had emerged from the back of the store and appointed herself my personal design consultant. Her name was Margaret. "Where are the beds?" I asked. She stiffened and informed me that this was not the kind of place where you could walk into a bedroom and see a row of beds lined up like pig's feet at a butcher shop. A Gomer Baldstrud home design gallery consists of a series of exquisitely decorated rooms, some of which happened to be bedrooms and to contain beds. Once we had that all straightened out, Margaret showed me the bedrooms. As she led me from one room to the next, I couldn't help noticing that she was wearing black stockings with seams up the back. Perfectly straight seams. My erotic feelings for Margaret made me uncomfortable. For a while, I had to restrain the impulse to say, "Just sell me the biggest, most expensive bed you have." Margaret showed me beds in different styles. The names of the styles meant nothing to me. Some looked modern and some looked old-fashioned. I pointed to a very large, high four-poster bed that looked like granny furniture and said, "I'll take one of those." There was a 3-month delay while the bed was hand-carved by New England craftsmen working at the same wage as plumbers or psychotherapists. Then it showed up at our house and was assembled by technicians in white coveralls, like the guys who work in semiconductor chip fabrication plants. Virginia came home from work. She was wearing a denim skirt, heavy wool socks, and Birkenstocks. The kids were still at school. We had sex on the bed. I performed dutifully enough, I suppose. I could not really sustain an erection and ended up with my head stuck between her bristly thighs. Even with my ears blocked by her quadriceps, I could hear her moaning and screaming. She went into erotic convulsions near the end and almost snapped my neck. Her climax must have lasted for 2 or 3 full minutes. This was the moment when I first came to terms with the fact that Virginia could not achieve orgasm unless she was in close proximity to, preferably on top of, a piece of heirloom-grade furniture that she owned. The window containing the image of Tom Howard's desktop vanishes. Pekka has clicked it into oblivion.
"I could not stand it anymore," he says, in his electronically generated deadpan.
"I predict a menage a trois. Tom, his wife, and Margaret doing it on a bed at the furniture store after hours," Cantrell says ruminatively.
"Is it Tom, or a fictional character of Tom's?" Pekka asks.
"Does this mean you win the bet?" Randy asks.
"If only I can figure out how to collect on it," Cantrell says.
Afloat. A brown miasma has settled across the Bismarck Sea, smelling of oil and barbecue. American torpedo boats hurtle out of this reeking fog, their fat hulls barely touching the water, their giant motors curving white scars into the sea as they line up their targets. The few remaining ships in Goto Dengo's troop convoy, whose decks are now covered with a dark mat of soldiers, like moss on an old rock. The torpedoes spring into the air like crossbow bolts, driven by compressed gas from tubes on the boat's decks. They belly flop into the water, settled to a comfortable depth where the water is always calm, and draw bubble trails across the sea, heading directly for the ships. The crowds on the ship's decks fluidize and gush over the edges. Goto Dengo turns away and hears, but doesn't see the explosions. Hardly any of the Nipponese troops know how to swim. Later, the airplanes come back to strafe them some more. Swimmers who have the wit and the ability to dive are invulnerable. Those who don't are dead very soon. The airplanes leave. Goto Dengo strips a life preserver off a shattered corpse. He has the worst sunburn of his life, and it is only mid-afternoon. So he pilfers a uniform blouse, too, and ties it around his head like a burnous. The ones who are still alive and who can swim try to converge on each other. They are in a complicated strait between New Guinea and New Britain, and tidal currents rushing through it tend to pull them apart. Some men drift slowly away, calling out to their comrades. Goto Dengo ends up on the fringes of a dissolving archipelago of maybe 100 swimmers. Many of them clutch life preservers or bits of wood to stay afloat. The seas are considerably higher than their heads, and so they can't see very far. Before sunset, the haze lifts for an hour. Goto Dengo can clearly fix the sun's position, so for the first time all day he knows west from east, north from south. Better, he can see peaks rising above the southern horizon, slathered with blue-white glaciers.
"I will swim to New Guinea,"
he shouts, and begins doing it. There is no point in trying to discuss it with the others. The ones who are inclined to follow him do, maybe a few dozen in all. The timing is right. The sea has become miraculously calm. Goto Dengo settles into a slow, easy side stroke. Most of the others are moving in an improvised dog paddle. If they are making any progress at all, it is totally imperceptible. As the stars begin to come out, he rolls over into a backstroke and gets a fix on Polaris. As long as he swims away from that, it is physically impossible for him to miss New Guinea. Darkness falls. Dim light is shed by the stars and by a half moon. The men call to one another, trying to stay bunched together. Some of them get lost. They can be heard but not seen, and those in the main group can do nothing but listen to their pleadings dwindle. It must be around midnight when the sharks come. The first victim is a man who has lacerated his forehead on a hatch frame when scrambling out of a sinking ship,
and who has been bleeding ever since, drawing a thin pink line across the sea, leading the sharks straight to them. The sharks do not yet know what they are dealing with, and so they kill him slowly, worrying him to death in small bites. When he turns out to be easy prey, they explode into some kind of berserk rage that is all the more fantastic for being hidden beneath the black water. Men's voices are cut off in mid-cry as they are jerked straight down. Sometimes a leg or a head will suddenly burst free from the surface. The water splashing into Goto Dengo's mouth begins to taste of iron. The attack goes on for several hours. It appears that the noise and smell have attracted some rival shark packs, because sometimes there is a lull, followed by renewed ferocity. A severed shark tail bumps up against Goto Dengo's face. He hangs on to it. The sharks are eating them. Why shouldn't he retaliate? In Tokyo, restaurants charge a lot of money for shark sashimi. The skin of the shark tail is tough, but hunks of muscle are hanging out of the torn edge. He buries his face in the meat and feasts on it. When Goto Dengo was young, his father had owned a fedora with English writing on its ivory silk liner, and a briar pipe and tobacco that he bought through the mail from America. He would sit on a rock up in the hills and snug his fedora down to keep the chilly air from the bald spot on top of his head, and smoke his pipe and just look at the world. "What are you doing?" Dengo would ask him. "Observing," father would say.
"But how long can you observe the same thing?"
"Forever. Look over there." Father pointed with the stem of his pipe. A thread of white smoke piped out of the mouthpiece, like a silk thread being unwound from a cocoon. "That band of dark rock is mineral-bearing. We could get copper out of there. Probably some zinc and lead, too. We would run a cog railway up the valley to that flat spot there, then sink an angle shaft parallel to the face of the deposit." Then Dengo would get into the act and decide where the workers would live, where the school would be built for their children, where the playing fields would be. By the time they were finished, they would have populated the whole valley with an imaginary city. Goto Dengo has plenty of time to make observations this night. He observes that severed body parts almost never get attacked. The men who swim most violently are always the first to get it. So, when the sharks come in, he tries to float on his back and not move a muscle, even when the jagged ends of someone's ribs poke him in the face. Dawn arrives. 100 or 200 hours after the previous sunset. He has never stayed awake all night long before and finds it shocking to see something as big as the sun go down on one side of the planet and come up on the opposite. He is a virus, a germ living on the surface of unfathomably giant bodies in violent motion. And amazingly enough, he is still not alone. 3 other men have survived the night of the sharks. They converge on one another and turn to face the ice-covered mountains of New Guinea, salmon-colored in the dawn light.
"They have not gotten any closer," one of the men says.
"They are deep in the interior,"
Goto Dengo says.
"We are not swimming to the mountains, only to the shore, much closer. Let's go before we die of dehydration."
And he plunges forward into a side stroke. One of the others, a boy who speaks with an Okinawa accent, is an excellent swimmer. He and Goto Dengo can easily outdistance the others. For most of the day, they try to stay together with the other two anyway. The waves come up and make it difficult even for good swimmers to move. One of the slower swimmers has been fighting diarrhea since long before his ship was sunk out from under him and was probably dehydrated to begin with. Around midday, when the sun is coming straight down on top of them like a flamethrower, he goes into convulsions, gets some water into his lungs, and disappears. The other slow swimmer is from Tokyo. He's in much better physical condition.
He simply doesn't know how to swim.
There is no better time or place to learn, Goto Dengo says.
He and the Okinawan spend an hour or so teaching him the side stroke and backstroke, and then they resume swimming southwards. Around sunset, Goto Dengo catches the Okinawan gulping down mouthful after mouthful of seawater. It is painful to watch, mostly because he himself has been wanting to do it.
No, it will make you sick,
he says. His voice is weak. The effort of filling his lungs, expanding his ribcage against the relentless pressure of the water, is ruining him. Every muscle in his torso is rigid and tender. The Okinawan has already started retching by the time Goto Dengo reaches him. With the help of the Tokyo boy, he sticks his fingers down the Okinawan's throat and gets him to vomit it all up. He is very sick anyway, and until late at night cannot do anything except float on his back and mumble deliriously. But just as Goto Dengo is about to abandon him, he becomes lucid, asking,
Where is Polaris?
It is cloudy tonight, Goto Dengo says. But there is a bright spot in the clouds that might be the moon.
Based on the position of that bright spot, they guess the position of New Guinea and resume swimming. Their arms and legs are like sacks of clay, and all of them are hallucinating. The sun seems to be coming up. They are in a nebula of vapor, radiant with peach-colored light, as if hurtling through a distant part of the galaxy.
I smell something rotten, says one of them.
Goto Dengo cannot tell which.
Gangrene,
guesses the other. Goto Dengo fills his nostrils, an act that consumes about half of his remaining energy reserves.
It is not rotten flesh,
he says.
It is vegetation.
None of them can swim anymore. If they could, they wouldn't know which direction to choose because the mist glows uniformly. If they picked a direction, it wouldn't matter, because the current is taking them where it will. Goto Dengo sleeps for a while. Or maybe he doesn't. Something bumps his leg. Thank God. The sharks have come to finish them. The waves have grown aggressive. He feels another bump. The burned flesh on his leg screams. It is something very hard, rough, and sharp. Something is projecting out of the water just ahead. Something bumpy and white. A coral head. A wave breaks behind them, picks them up, and flings them forward across the coral, half flaying them. Goto Dengo breaks a finger and counts himself lucky. The next breaker takes what little skin he has left and flings him into a lagoon. Something forces his feet upwards, and because his body is just a limp sack of shit at this point, doubles him over head first into the water. His face strikes a bed of sharp coral sand. Then his hands are in it too. His limbs have forgotten how to do anything except swim, and so it takes him a while to plant them in the bottom and lift his head out of the water. Then he begins to crawl on his hands and knees. The odor of rotten vegetation is overpowering now, as if a whole division's food supplies had been left out in the sun for a week. He finds some sand that is not covered with water, turns around, and sits down on it. The Okinawan is right behind him, also on hands and knees, and the Tokyo boy has actually clambered to his feet and is wading ashore, being knocked this way and that by incoming waves. He is laughing. The Okinawan boy collapses on the sand next to Goto Dengo, not even trying to sit up. A wave knocks the Tokyo boy off balance. Laughing, he collapses sideways into the surf, throwing out one hand to break his fall. He stops laughing and jerks back sharply. Something is dangling from his forearm. A wriggling snake. He snaps it like a whip and it flies off into the water. Scared and sober, he splashes the last half dozen steps up onto the beach and then falls flat on his face.
By the time Gotodango reaches him, he is stone dead. Gotodango gathers his forces for some period of time that is difficult to measure. He may have fallen asleep sitting up. The Okinawan boy is still lying on the sand, raving. Gotodango gets his feet underneath himself and staggers off in search of fresh water. This is not a proper beach. Merely a sandbar, maybe 10 meters long and 3 wide, with some tall grassy stuff sprouting out of the top. On the other side of it is a brackish lagoon that meanders between banks, not of earth, but of living things all tangled together. That tangle is obviously too thick to penetrate. So, notwithstanding what just happened to the Tokyo boy, Gotodango wades into the lagoon, hoping that it will lead inland to a freshwater stream. He wanders for what seems like an hour, but the lagoon takes him back to the edge of the sea again. He gives up and drinks the water he's wading in, hoping it will be a little less salty. This leads to a great deal of vomiting, but makes him feel slightly better somehow. Again he wades into the swamp, trying to keep the sound of the surf behind him, and after an hour or so he finds a rivulet of water that is actually fresh. When he has finished drinking from that, he feels strong enough to go back and carry the Okinawan boy here, if need be. He gets back to the beach in mid-afternoon and finds that the Okinawan is gone, but the sand is all churned up by footprints. The sand is dry, and so the footprints are too indistinct to read. They must have made contact with a patrol. Surely their comrades must have heard about the attack on the convoy and are combing beaches for survivors. There must be a bivouac in the jungle not far away. Gotodango follows the trail into the jungle. After he's proceeded a mile or so, the track crosses a small open mudflat where he gets a good look at the footprints, all made by bare feet, with enormous, bizarrely splayed toes. Footprints of people who have never worn shoes in their lives. He proceeds more cautiously for another few hundred meters. He can hear voices now. The army taught him all about jungle infiltration tactics, how to creep through the enemy's lines in the middle of the night without making a sound. Of course, when they practiced it in a pond, they weren't being eaten alive by ants and mosquitoes the whole time. But it hardly matters to him now. An hour of patient work gets him to a vantage point from which he can see into a flat clearing with a stagnant creek wandering through it. Several long, dark houses are built on tree trunk stilts to keep them up out of the ooze, and roofed with bushy heaps of palm fronds. Before he finds the Okinawan, Gotodango needs to get some food. In the middle of the clearing, white porridge is steaming in a pot over an open fire. But it's being tended by several tough-looking women, naked, except for short fringes of fibrous stuff tied round their waists and just barely concealing their genitals. Smoke is rising from some of the long buildings, too. But to get inside one of them, he would have to clamber up its heavy slanting ladder and then worm through what looks like a rather small doorway. A child standing inside one of those doorways with a stick could prevent an intruder from coming in. Hanging outside some of the doorways are sacks, improvised from lengths of fabric, so at least they have textiles, and filled with big round lumps. Coconuts, possibly, or some kind of preserved food set up to keep it away from the ants. Perhaps 70 people are gathered around something of interest in the middle of the clearing. As they move around, Gotodango gets occasional momentary glimpses of someone, possibly Nipponese, who is sitting at the base of a palm tree with his hands behind his back. There's a lot of blood on his face, and he's not moving. Most of these people are men, and they tend to carry spears. They have those fringes of hairy stuff, sometimes dyed red or green, concealing their private parts, and some of the bigger and older ones have decorated themselves by tying strips of fabric around their arms. Some have painted designs on their skin in pale mud. They have shoved various objects,
some of them quite large, sideways through their nasal septums. The bloodied man seems to have captured everyone's attention, and Goto Dengo reckons that this will be his only chance to steal some food. He picks the longhouse farthest away from where the villagers have gathered, clambers up its ladder, and reaches for the bulging sack that hangs by the entrance. But the fabric is very old, and it is rotted from the damp of the swamp, and maybe from the attacks of the hundreds of flies that buzz around it. And so when he grasps it, his fingers go right through. A long swath of it tears away, and the contents tumble out around Goto Dango's feet. They are dark and sort of hairy, like coconuts, but their shape is more complicated. And he knows intuitively that something is wrong even before he recognizes them as human skulls. Maybe half a dozen of them. Scalp and skin still stuck on. Some of them are dark-skinned, with bushy hair like the natives, and others look distinctly Nipponese. Sometime later, he is able to think coherently again. He realizes that he does not know how long he might have spent up here, in full view of the villagers, gazing on the skulls. He turns around to look, but all attention is still focused on the wounded man seated at the base of the tree. From this vantage point, Goto Dango is able to see that it is indeed the Okinawan, and that his arms have been tied together behind the tree trunk. A boy of maybe 12 is standing over him, holding a spear. He steps forward cautiously and suddenly pokes it into the midsection of the Okinawan, who comes awake and thrashes from side to side. The boy is obviously startled by this and jumps back. Then an older man, his head decorated with a fringe of cowrie shells, takes a stance behind and beside the boy, showing him how to hold the spear, guiding him forward again. He adds his own strength to the youngsters, and they shove the spear straight into the Okinawan's heart. Goto Dango falls off the house. The men become very excited, and pick the boy up on their shoulders and parade him around the clearing, hollering and leaping and twirling, jabbing their spears defiantly into the air. They are pursued by all but the very youngest children. Goto Dango, bruised but not damaged by the fall onto the mucky ground, belly crawls into the jungle and looks for a place of concealment. The women of the village carry pots and knives towards the Okinawan's body and begin to cut it up with the conspicuous skill of a sushi chef dismantling a tuna. One of them is concentrating entirely on his head. Suddenly she jumps into the air and begins to dance around the clearing, waving something bright and glittery.
Ulab! Ulab! Ulab!
She cries ecstatically. Some women and children begin following her around, trying to get a look at whatever it is she's holding. Finally she stops and centers her hand in a rare shaft of sunlight coming down through the trees. Resting in the palm of her hand is a gold tooth.
Ulab!
Say the women and children. One of the kids tries to snatch it out of her hand, and she knocks him flat on his ass. Then one of the big spear-carrying men runs up, and she hands the booty over to him. Several of the men now gather round to marvel at the find. The women go back to working over the Okinawan boy, and soon his body parts are stewing in pots over an open fire.